Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey, and the rest of these gentlemen, having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted, I take up my pen and go back to the time when my father kept the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the brown old seaman, with the sabre cut, first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a handbarrow, a tall, strong, heavy, nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulders of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred, with black broken nails, and the sabre cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking round the cove and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out in that old sea song that he sang so often afterwards. 15 men on the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum, in his high, old, tottering voice. Then he rapped on the door, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly, like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste, and still looking about him. "This is a handy cove," says he at length, "and a pleasant-situated grog-shop. Much company, mate?" My father told him no, very little company, the more was the pity. "Well, then," said he, "this is the berth for me. I'll stay here a bit. I'm a plain man. Rum and bacon and eggs is what I want, and that head up there for to watch ships off. What you might call me? You might call me Captain." He threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I've worked through that," says he. Our guest was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung round the cove or upon the cliffs with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in a corner of the parlour next to the fire, and drank rum and water very strong. We and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day, when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring men had gone by along the road. At first we thought it was the want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question, but at last we began to see he was desirous to avoid them. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was, in a way, a sharer in his alarms. He had taken me aside one day, and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month if I would only keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg, and let him know the moment he appeared. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights, when the wind shook the four corners of the house and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in 1,000 forms and with 1,000 diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of creature who had never had but the one leg, and that in the middle of his body. Altogether I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece in the shape of these abominable fancies. He kept on staying, week after week, and at last month after month, so that all the money had been long exhausted, and still my father never plucked up the heart to insist on having more. All the time he lived with us, the captain made no change whatever in his dress but to buy some stockings from a hawker. I remember the appearance of his coat, which he patched himself upstairs in his room, and which before the end was nothing but patches. He never wrote or received a letter, and he never spoke with any but the neighbours, and with these, for the most part, only when drunk on rum. The great sea chest none of us had ever seen open. He was only once crossed, and that was towards the end when my poor father was far gone in a decline that took him off. Dr. Livesey came late one afternoon to see the patient, took a bit of dinner from my mother, and went into the parlour to smoke a pipe until his horse should come down from the hamlet, for we had no stabling at the old Benbow. I followed him in, and I remember observing the contrast the neat, bright doctor and his bright black eyes and pleasant manners made with that filthy, heavy, bleared scarecrow of a pirate of ours, sitting far gone in rum, with his arms on the table. Suddenly he, the captain, that is, began to pipe up his eternal song.
15 men on the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. Drink, and the devil had done for the rest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum.
The captain gradually brightened up at his own music, and at last clapped his hand upon the table before him in a way we all knew to mean silence. The voices stopped at once. All but Dr. Livesey's. He went on as before, speaking clear and kind, and drawing briskly at his pipe between every word or two. The captain glared at him for a while, flapped his hand again, glared still harder, and at last broke out with a villainous low oath,
"Silence there between decks!"
"Were you addressing me, sir?" says the doctor. And when the ruffian had told him with another oath that this was so, "I have only one thing to say to you, sir," replies the doctor, "that if you keep on drinking rum, the world will soon be quit of a very dirty scoundrel." The old fellow's fury was awful. He sprang to his feet, drew and opened a sailor's clasp knife, and balancing it open on the palm of his hand, threatened to pin the doctor to the wall. The doctor never so much as moved. "If you do not put that knife this instant in your pocket, I promise upon my honour you shall hang at next assizes. I'm not a doctor only, I'm a magistrate. And if I catch a breath of complaint against you, if it's only for a piece of incivility like tonight's, I'll take effectual means to have you hunted down and routed out of this. Let that suffice." Soon after, Dr. Livesey's horse came to the door, and he rode away. But the captain held his peace that evening, and for many evenings to come. It was not very long after this that there occurred the first of the mysterious events that rid us at last of the captain, though not, as you will see, of his affairs. It was a bitter, cold winter, with long, hard frosts and heavy gales, and it was plain from the first that my poor father was little likely to see the spring. He sank daily, and my mother and I had all the inn upon our hands, and we were kept busy enough, without paying much regard to our unpleasant guest. It was one January morning, very early, a pinching, frosty morning. Mother was upstairs with father, and I was laying the breakfast table against the captain's return, when the parlour door opened, and a man stepped in, on whom I had never set my eyes before. He was a pale, tallowy creature, wanting two fingers of the left hand, and though he wore a cutlass, he did not look much like a fighter.
"Come here, sonny," said he to me. "Come nearer, here."
I took a step nearer.
"Is this here table for my mate Bill?"
he asked with a kind of leer. I told him I did not know his mate Bill, and this was for a person who stayed in our house whom we called the captain.
"Well," said he, "my mate Bill would be called the captain as like as not. We'll put it for argument like that your captain has a cut on one cheek, and we'll put it if you like that that cheek's the right one. Ah, well, I told you. Now, is my mate Bill in this here house?"
I told him he was out walking. The stranger waited in a corner of the room. At last, in strode the captain, slammed the door behind him without looking to the right or left, and marched straight across the room to where his breakfast awaited him.
"Bill," said the stranger.
The captain spun round on his heel and fronted us. He had the look of a man who sees a ghost. The captain made a sort of gasp.
"Black dog," said he. "And who else?" returned the other, getting more at his ease. "Black dog as ever was, come for to see his old shipmate Billy."
I thought I should best leave these two alone, and withdrew from the parlour. For a long time, though I certainly did my best to listen, I could hear nothing but a low gabbling. But at last the voices began to grow higher. Then, all of a sudden, there was a tremendous explosion of oaths and other noises. The chair and table went over in a lump, a clash of steel followed, and then a cry of pain. and the next instant I saw Black Dog in full flight and the captain hotly pursuing. Black Dog, in spite of a wound to his shoulder, showed a wonderful clean pair of heels and disappeared over the edge of the hill in half a minute. The captain, for his part, stood staring at the signboard like a bewildered man. Then he passed his hand over his eyes several times, and at last turned back into the house.
"Jim," says he, "rum."
And as he spoke, he reeled a little and caught himself with one hand against the wall.
"Jim," he said at length, "you saw that seafaring man?"
"Black Dog?" I asked.
"Ah, Black Dog," says he. "He's a bad un, but there's worse than put him on. Now, if I can't get away nohow, and they tip me the black spot, mind you, it's my old sea chest they're after. You get on a horse. You can't you? Well then, you get on a horse and go to that eternal doctor swab and tell him to pipe all hands, magistrates and such, and he'll lay 'em aboard at the Admiral Benbow. All old Flint's crew, man and boy, all on 'em that's left. I was first mate, I was. Old Flint's first mate. And I'm the only one as knows the place. He gave it me to Savannah when he lay a-dying. Like as if I was to now, you see. But you won't peach, unless they get the black spot on me, or unless you see that black dog again, or a seafaring man with one leg, Jim. Him above all."
"But what is the black spot, Captain?" I asked.
"That's a summons, mate. I'll tell you if they get that. But keep your weather eye open, Jim, and I'll share with you equals, upon my honour."
As things fell out, my poor father died quite suddenly that evening, which put all other matters on one side. Our natural distress, the visits of the neighbours, the arranging of the funeral, and all the work of the inn to be carried on in the meanwhile, kept me so busy that I had scarcely time to think of the captain, far less to be afraid of him. On the night before the funeral, he was as drunk as ever, and it was shocking in that house of mourning to hear him singing away at his ugly old sea-song. So things passed until the day after the funeral, and about 3 o'clock of a bitter, foggy, frosty afternoon, I was standing at the door for a moment, full of sad thoughts about my father, when I saw someone drawing slowly near along the road. He was plainly blind, for he tapped before him with a stick, and wore a great green shade over his eyes and nose, and he was hunched, as if with age or weakness, and wore a huge old tattered sea cloak with a hood that made him appear positively deformed. I never saw in my life a more dreadful-looking figure. He stopped a little from the inn, and raising his voice in an old sing-song, addressed the air in front of him.
"Will any kind friend inform a poor blind man, who's lost the precious sight of his eyes in the gracious defence of his native country, England, and God bless King George, where or in what part of this country he may now be?"
"You are at the Admiral Benbow, Black Hill Cove, my good man," said I.
"Will you give me your hand, my kind young friend, and lead me in?" said he.
I held out my hand, and the horrible, soft-spoken, eyeless creature gripped it in a moment like a vice. I was so much startled that I struggled to withdraw, but the blind man pulled me close up to him with a single action of his arm.
"Now, boy," he said, "take me into the captain, take me in straight, or I'll break your arm."
And he gave it, as he spoke, a wrench that made me cry out. I began to obey him at once, walking straight in at the door and towards the parlour where our sick old buccaneer was sitting dazed with rum. The poor captain raised his eyes, and at one look the rum went out of him and left him staring sober. The expression of his face was not so much of terror as of mortal sickness. He made a movement to rise, but I do not believe he had enough force left in his body.
"Now, Bill, sit where you are," said the beggar. "If I can't see, I can hear a finger stirring. Business is business. Hold out your left hand, boy. Take his left hand by the wrist and bring it near to my right."